This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
All right, so the time is 11 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. On Monday, Britain imposed sanctions against businesses which support activity of the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF, and also the Rapid Support Forces. The Canadian Foreign Ministry has also announced that Canada is introducing new sanction measures against the Special Economic Measures Act in response to the ongoing conflict in Sudan. Now, it was around last year, early last year, where it all kicked off in Sudan. The SAF versus the Rapid Support Forces. And what we're told is all of these members of the military were all once part of a single fraternity, all right? Generals, buddies, pals, propping up the government of Omar al-Bashir. And then things went south between, or sour, between some of the generals, and then members of the military then split up into militia and then began fighting against each other. Heavy gunfire was first recorded on the 15th of April, 2023 in Khartoum. And since then, the situation has degenerated significantly. Not only has sporadic fighting continued, but some of the worst atrocities have also been recorded in Sudan. In fact, there's been an alarm sounded by women in the Sudan who are able to get messages out to the rest of the world saying that rape is now being used as an instrument of war. And one of the horrible, horrible repercussions of this particular conflict is the weaponization of sex and sexual violence. And it's becoming very, in fact, they're saying it's at a proportion where almost every household can now record an act of sexual violence in this conflict. Moussam Dunge, good morning. He is a political analyst and comparative politics seminal teacher at the University of Dundee. Good morning, Moussa.
Good morning.
And thank you so much for coming through. So perhaps remind us, what happened on the 15th of April, 2023, between the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces? And who are the main antagonists in this story? I'm going to say that. General Abdel Fattah Burhan and General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
Yes, indeed. So, you know, a year ago, we saw Sudan basically fall into a civil war. And this comes at a time where the country, and in particular, if you take Sudan, when it was united, both South Sudan and Sudan, a country that was led by al-Bashir, which in many ways, you know, we saw huge atrocities happen. So this civil war comes at a time where the country had finally liberated itself from the clutches of al-Bashir. But unfortunately, the generals who were charged with a transitional government, moving Sudan away from a dictatorship as it had been to a new democratic country under democratic values and institutions, as aspired by the Sudanese people. Unfortunately, last year what we saw were these two generals, two factions fundamentally being formed that were trying to, rather than move towards a transition towards democracy that would return power back to a civilian government, rather they fought a war to maintain power under the control of the military. And so we saw in Sudan, the Sudanese armed forces under Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, under Janjaweed leader Hamadid. You know, and so these were former allies who are critical in the transitional process for Sudan. And all of a sudden, these two men had decided to then go to war. And what we then saw on the 21st of January 2024 was at least 13,000 to 15,000 people being killed, another further 33,000 people being injured. And as of the 21st of March, what we have seen is 6.5 million people being displaced in that country, around neighboring countries in the region.
Okay, so there's a lot going on here, but simply put, these were all allies, generals amalgamated in one army, and they were tasked with leading Sudan out of an impasse into a democratic transition, because we did see the deposition of Omar al-Bashir, his arrest as well. But instead of doing that, managing a transition, they started fighting amongst themselves. They did not fast track the path to elections and a democracy, if that would be the outcome of a negotiated settlement, and instead went back to war. And so this is really something that gives credence to that African adage where when two elephants fight, it is the grass that suffers. So 6.5 million people displaced, you know, millions others caught up in the crossfire, not because of what they did or said, but because two elephants are fighting.
Yes. And furthermore, you know, the fact that we're speaking about Sudan, we must remember that, you know, this is a country that has huge history of conflict. And this conflict has often consisted, if you think about it, of foreign invasions, resistance, you know, ethnic tensions, religious disputes. And, you know, perhaps the most common of them, particularly when you think about African states, a dispute over resources. And so what we're seeing in Sudan is very interesting, and for the region very consequential, because when you look at its geopolitical location and geoeconomical location, it is located in the Nile Basin, a very critical area when you think about what the importance of the Nile River to the economic sustenance of countries such as Egypt. And when we think about what is currently happening around Ethiopia's development of a dam, a hydro energy dam in its own country, you know, Sudan was very critical for that tripartite alliance around an agreement on how best to ensure that they manage the dam, but the flows of water. And so war in this particular country puts in jeopardy those negotiations, those talks, and the greater stability of the region.
Well, we'll talk about the regional impact in a moment, Musa, but thank you for flagging it up for us. You use the term, one of them used to run a paramilitary group. So please help us understand sort of how power is brokered in the Sudan, I think is a word I should use. Because we're told in the al-Bashir years, just before the coup that ousted the government that was there for a long, long time, is that you had a formal army.
Yes.
But even within the formal army were paramilitary groups, which acted as a presidential guard. So militia seems to be a way in which the formal establishment has functioned in Sudan. Please explain why that is.
Indeed, you know, they have functioned like this, particularly because when we think of the kind of dictator that al-Bashir was, you know, he created almost these paramilitary groups in order to strengthen his own power, his own hold over power, particularly in a country where there are several factional groups that hold power and sway, particularly when we think within the military. And so it was important in furtherance of increasing his power, consolidating his power, that he would create these militias. Now, the problem is the legacy of that is that even in the toppling of al-Bashir, it took in part with the resistance as pushed by the people. There was a strong concerted effort by the paramilitary militia as led by the rapid special forces, also played a role in pushing al-Bashir out of power. As I said, both these groups were once one. And this is key to understand why democracy hasn't taken root, why the transition to democracy is unlikely to happen unless we see an even stronger external push by external players. Unfortunately, within the country, no group really has an appetite towards democracy, because democracy would mean returning power and control over resources, which is fundamentally the key to why both the UK and Canada have imposed sanctions. The role of resources in feeding and propping up these paramilitary groups and the militias that are operating in Sudan currently. They feed off the trade and export of goods such as gold. When you think of countries like the UAE being key markets for Sudanese exports.
Okay.
And so this is really what we see here, that a move towards democracy, Lerato, would fundamentally mean letting go of control over key resources.
Okay.
And this is why the transition is unlikely to happen.
All right. Let's talk about those resources, and let's also talk about a statement you made. Let's remember you said Sudan is a country that has known a lot of conflict. And I think it rings true, but we need the context. So for many, many years, even if there was a stable government in Khartoum, led by Omar al-Bashir, as complex a figure and divisive a figure as he is, he was the overarching political figure in Khartoum. And at the time, Sudan was a huge country which had a southern part. And the southern part were embroiled in a conflict because they wanted their freedom, which was ultimately given to them, called South Sudan. So that's one conflict. There was another conflict on the southwestern front, which is in an area known as Darfur. And there were militia, and the militia loyal, were told, to the government in Khartoum, known as the Janjaweed. So there's always been conflict on Sudanese soil. And at times, the conflict is embedded in those who are resisting the status quo and those militia who are linked to the establishment. Help us understand that.
Indeed. So fundamentally, you know, as I said, that, you know, this particular conflict is one that is rooted in a power struggle, right? A power struggle linked to the resources, and a power struggle that is also linked to ethnical divisions within that country that date back to the colonial period and that colonial heritage that, you know, African countries are still to this day struggling with. And so fundamentally, you're dealing with a country where Omar al-Bashir was fighting a war on two fronts, both the war in Darfur and then dealing with the challenge that he was facing in South Sudan, where South Sudanese people were effectively fighting for their independence and freedom and ability for self-determination. And so a country such as this has not really known a period fundamentally of peace, where people are united behind the idea and identity of what it means to be a Sudanese person. And fundamentally, that is why any objective, any push towards a process of democracy has really been hard done. And so we see it with the fact that here are these two gentlemen who have had an opportunity to move Sudan towards democracy, towards peace, but they themselves are influenced by these power dynamics and power brokers. And again, Sudanese is not an island here. It is a country that is heavily influenced by the region that it finds itself and by even the former colonial powers and emerging powers that see Sudan as a critical country in terms of trade, in terms of trade when you think about Port Sudan, which sits in a critical region in terms of the Suez Canal. And this is why we find ourselves here. It is a country that has always been important for the role it plays in terms of energy, in terms of oil, as well as that gold trade. And unfortunately, given the struggle for these resources, this is why we find ourselves in a place where democracy is unlikely to take root in this country unless there is a dramatic external push for that to happen.
Okay. And then very briefly, I don't want to belabor the issue on resources. The fact that South Sudan ultimately gained its independence, I mean, they've got their own internal problems, but one of the One of the concessions was that they are going to take the oil wells, which really sit on South Sudanese soil, but the pipelines have to flow through, I think, the north. And so the royalties have to be paid to the north. Is that an issue at play?
That is an issue at play. And this is the unique, what makes this conflict so unique is that though South Sudan holds the bulk of the oil wealth, unfortunately, the bulk of the oil refineries are controlled in the north, and the north is very important to ensure that that oil flows. So unfortunately for South Sudan, they find themselves at a place where they are fundamentally at the mercy of the north, and in many ways, it would be hard to see any condition in which the guys in the south are themselves not vested in the conflict as we find it in Sudan. So in many ways, we are seeing countries that are facing conflicts within themselves, but are also heavily involved in what is happening in the other country. And that's what's making this conflict that are so unique and so complex, and why the solutions towards this conflict are not going to be easy, because they rely on what happens in the other country as well.
Okay. And a country that they used to be part of more than a decade ago. Okay. The United Nations has raised serious concerns about the situation in Sudan, the crisis itself, but also the escalating levels of violence and the indiscriminate attacks, which the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres describes as war crimes and crimes against humanity. So you've mentioned the displacement of 6.5 million people. They say that 1.6 million have fled to neighboring countries. They say that 25 million people are facing a humanitarian crisis, shortages of food and water because they've had to leave their homes, their towns that they have made a life in. And then there is a concern being raised, Musa, about rape as an instrument of war in this conflict. And why is that?
Yeah, so, you know, this has really been one of the huge concerns that has been raised around this particular conflict, you know, and it's not necessarily unique to it. We know that, you know, when we just study conflicts, just looking at Africa, there've been many stories of rape happening in conflict situations. And so Sudan is such a country, and this is not the first time that reports have been raised. In fact, when we look at the Amnesty International, they've raised these issues since 2003, and other organizations as well have repeatedly documented evidence of war crimes, of crimes against humanity, and particularly this issue around the rape of women and girls, you know, who are used as pawns in this particular conflict, and whose human rights are undermined in this particular conflict. And so that is why there is a need, again, as you've so put it well in this question, to remember what this is about and the importance that all nations have placed to that responsibility to protect R2P, as they all signed up to in 2005 when they all met up at a world summit to discuss what is the right response by nations when their fellow countries are committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And in this particular case, all countries said that in this particular case, territorial sovereignty does not hold. There is a need for countries to intervene through the United Nations. So unfortunately, as much as we're hearing from the United Nations concerns, the gridlock still lies in the United Nations Security Council and the kind of response that nations can give.
You know, when we talk about sexual violence, and I don't want to focus too much on it, it's triggering also, is that it's not just been used in conflicts in Africa. It's been a tactic deployed in Bosnia and that horrible war in Bosnia and Yugoslavia. And in the Ukraine, there have been allegations of it as well.
Yes.
And what experts say is once you start using sexual violence as a weapon of war, it's because it's the early stages of a kind of an ethnic cleansing. Because the idea is if you can impregnate women on the other side with children from the enemy side, then you wipe out an existing population through the killings, but you birth a new population of what you deem an ethnically superior race.
Yes, so that is the worry here, right? That is the worry. And you think about the fact that we are currently commemorating 30 years since the Rwandan genocide. So Sudan is really a flag point of where this conflict is moving and the failure of nations to intervene. And particularly here, Lerato, then one needs to also then mention the role of the African Union. What is its responsibility? Yeah. What is the responsibility of regional players? What is the responsibility of regional players, but particularly the African Union? We know South Africa has tried to play its role in this particular conflict and continues to offer support, but more needs to be done by African countries to really press on both parties, particularly when it comes to whether it be through sanctions, arms embargo. Okay. But there must be an attempt by African countries to send a strong message in order to avoid any moves that would drive us towards that particular point, a point at which it may be even more difficult to find peace in that particular region. And also think of the social impact that such a conflict would have, such a genocide would have on the region itself. And the security implications that it would bore on the region. So there's a need for African countries to step up more so than they have, rather than leave it to external powers.
Musa Mtunga, it's always a pleasure. He's a political analyst and comparative politics seminal teacher at the University of Dundee, almost a year to the day when the war broke out in Sudan. First, it's two generals against each other, fighting for resources. It's the displacement of over 8.5 million people fleeing the country that they know, their cities, their towns. It's a humanitarian crisis brewing. It's then the sexualization of women in what becomes the early stages of a kind of an ethnic cleansing. And then it's the regionalization of the conflicts, because there's still a hotspot in Darfur, which has a quarter of the Sudanese population. It's the choking of the oil wells in South Sudan, which used to be part of Sudan. And then it's the regional impact where all these countries, this country sits on the Nile River Basin, and the countries and neighboring states have been arguing over who has the rights to the waters of the Nile as Ethiopia builds a Renaissance dam. And so that starts to have the regional impact. May we not forget the Sudan.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.